Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio. If you want to listen to the most interesting people, you won't find them in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Increasingly, it's getting harder to find them anywhere on the internet as people get deplatformed and censored. So, your one-stop shop for finding all of the most interesting voices is my work here at Truth Jihad Radio and at False Flag Weekly News. You can find all of that by way of truthjihad.com, where you could drop a tip in the PayPal button if you feel like it. I also have a Patreon page. I'm Dr. Kevin Barrett on patreon.com, where you can subscribe and get free downloads and early access to all my shows. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, broadcasting out of an undisclosed location somewhere in locked down southwestern Wisconsin, trying to figure out what's going on in the world and bringing on the most interesting people who might have a clue. Today, bringing on one of the real legends of alternative media and analysis, and that's Daniel Estulin. He's most famous for helping break the story of the Bilderberg Group, which is now actually officially admitted to in mainstream circles, but it didn't used to be. Daniel Estulin has a quite interesting analysis of a whole range of topics, and many of them sort of coalesce around the coronavirus crisis. And from what I've seen, I think his analysis is spot on. But let's get into it and find out. Hey, welcome, Daniel Estulin. Good to have you back.
It is so wonderful to be on your show again. It's wonderful to talk to you again from an undisclosed location in beautiful Mexico, on the beach, enjoying the sun, coronavirus free.
So they're not going to arrest you for being alone on a huge beach?
Well, Mexico is a kind of a great place because it's all very lax. Do you know what I mean? I mean, they try to make it official. You know, they try to, like, you know, keep up with the rules and the regulations, but it's very difficult to do that. And you know, just because of the nature of the country itself. So it's, you know, you kind of go along with this. You wear the mask to the store. You keep your social distancing, which isn't like, you know, 6 feet, but usually about 2.5 because you're in your store looking at something. There's going to be 3 fat Mexicans right behind you looking at the same thing. But it's a great, a lot of fun because my Spanish is fluent because I've lived 24 years in Spain. It's a beautiful place to be. And again, if you're not in America, you know, Mexico is the place.
Well, that's great. Yeah. The, as you say,
a
the
Republican
culture.
America, I should say, not Democratic because that's a nut house.
Yeah. Well, I think they're both nut houses actually, but, at least, right now, the Republican side is the more interesting and, the less locked down nut house, I suppose.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And so let's talk about where did this thing come from? You know, when I'm thinking, you know, I should have seen this coming. I feel like, you know, with 9/11, it took me 2 years to really get up to speed. This time I'm suspicious from the get go. And even I'm thinking I'm still slow though. You know, it took me 2 years to figure out 9/11. Well, this time I should have figured this out even before it happened. I should have known that something very much like this was likely to happen. It's just too convenient for so many people. So let's talk a little bit about whether you agree with that. And if so, how you see this, where did it come from?
Well, you know, again, if you kind of look at the numbers, you're looking at a global debt of $4 quadrillion. When you add all the, you know, obligations and all the monies owed by the government, et cetera. So when you kind of governments, so you kind of start looking at the system, you're saying like, well, you know, they can't pay this thing off. There's no way they can pay it off. And how do you write off such an enormous debt of $4 quadrillion? Well, actually, there's only one way of doing this. It's called force majeure. And force majeure is, you know, it's some kind of a naturally occurring event or, you know, not naturally, like, you know, a global thermonuclear war. But what it does, it allows the, you know, the elite circles, the supranational powers, the deep state, to write off debts and responsibilities, not via some little piddly, you know, regional conflict, but a global thermonuclear war. And so they tried that, you know, that attack with Soleimani when they killed him on the 3rd of January, 2020, because, you know, the Middle East is the powder keg of the Russians, the Israelis, the Chinese, the Americans, the Turks are there, the Iranians are there, everyone is there, you know, so it was just, you know, they're hoping that you can get this thing going because you have the Jews, you know, and nuclear weapons on the one hand and Arabs and petrol and oil on the other. I mean, you can't think of a more explosive combination, but, you know, nothing happened because the powers that be the countries themselves had no appetite for global thermonuclear war with all the consequences for us, the great unwashed, as Kissinger calls us, And also for them, because of the ramifications post thermonuclear war. So they came up with, you know, with plan B, because again, another plan B would have been Godzilla, would have been, you know, maybe gigantic tsunami that will, you know, wipe half of the world off, or some earthquake, or, you know, meteorite hitting the planet Earth, but none of those things were available.
How about a fake alien invasion?
Well, fake alien invasion, exactly. I was going to just say that, exactly. Well, you know, you have Pentagon distracting everyone with shots of alien spaceships. So none of it panned out. So what's your plan B, real plan B? Well, you have some kind of a bacteriological war. Now, let me explain to you how this works. I kind of created a little story to help people understand. So you have this global powers, the global elite, doesn't matter what they're called. And they realize that the world is about to collapse, because this is a systemic collapse. This isn't 2008 when you had, you know, what they call the subprime. Yeah, I think I'm right. Subprime. Forgive for the Freudian slip. Or what they call the Lehman Brothers, which really wasn't the Lehman Brothers or the subprime. It was the first death knell of this generalized global systemic collapse, because we reached the limits of growth. And this is rather systemic for the entire planet. The entire system is in a state of collapse. And so they realize that they need to do something to write out all these debts and also responsibilities, and also, you know, because people are going to realize when the system collapses and you have 90% of the world population unemployed, somebody's going to have to pay the price, and they don't want that to be them, the elite. So they devise a virus. And needless to say, when you devise a virus, you also have a vaccine ready. Nobody's going to have a virus without having a vaccine ready, you know, beforehand. And they go to the general director of the World Health Organization and explain to him the situation, and they ask him very nicely for the World Health Organization to call this thing a global pandemic. If the guy or he or she, doesn't matter who runs the World Health Organization, because again, it's a private institution controlled and financed by the Rockefellers, by the Soros, Gateses, etc. If the guy agrees, great. If he doesn't agree, if he thinks this is too much, because remember, they lowered the standards for calling it a pandemic a few years back, obviously getting ready for what's coming. You know, then they sweeten the pot. They offer him, I don't know, let's say $300 billion, $400 billion, you know, to fight this thing for World Health Organization. It's, you know, this is just paper money that they print anyway. If the guy agrees, great. If he doesn't agree, then they sweeten the pot again. They offer him personally $100 million or $200 million. It doesn't matter, which he can deposit into any bank account he wants in the world. Again, if he agrees, great. If he doesn't, then they offer him Nobel Peace Prize. And they say, hey, look, we gave it to Obama. I mean, why wouldn't we give it to you to fight the pandemic? You're going to be on the cover of the magazines as the man who saved the entire humanity. If he agrees, wonderful. If he's still not sure about this, then they really, really go after him. They say, look, if you don't agree to call this a pandemic, we're going to kill you. We've killed Kennedy. We've killed so many other presidents of the United States and other presidents and prime ministers of other countries. I mean, we are behind 9/11. What's in the end for us to, you know, to create this thing, put it on the cover of the New York Times? And people are dumb. They're going to believe any old crap that comes out there. And so he understands that, you know, whether he likes it or he doesn't like it, he's going to have to call this thing a pandemic. Because I think any thinking individual out there has to understand that for the World Health Organization to call something a pandemic, a lot of money has to change hands, because it's not about saving lives. And so we have the World Health Organization, WHO, agreeing to this. Now, the thing is, how do you get presidents and the entire structure of governments and countries? Because people think this is impossible, but it's actually very easy, because the global elite, they control the media. They control, you know, via the military-industrial complex. And if you control the media, you control the dialectic, which means you can put enormous pressure, as we've seen over the last 3.5 years with Donald Trump, how easily the media can control the dialectic, whether it's left, whether it's right, whether it's center, whether it's extreme left-right, it doesn't matter. All media is in the hands of these people. And when you control the media, it becomes very easy to control presidents. And most presidents are going to fall in line anyway, because they're part of the system. They're part of this global liberal banking financier apparatus, which is one system since 1991, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Before, we had two systems between 44 and 91, the capitalist West and the socialist Soviet Union. and satellites. And then in 1991, it became one global system. So most presidents are already controlled by these people. And an occasional president who is not, you threaten him, you cajole him, you offer him money, you say, look, just, you know, say the magic word, pandemic, you're going to have money raining at you from the UN, from the World Health Organization, from private foundations, private donors, because you're such a good person for fighting this thing globally. And if you don't, we can kill you. You will not win the next elections. We're going to make you, you know, into this pariah, and we're going to, you know, bring you as, you know, as the man responsible for killing, you know, unseemly number of people because of your, you know, ineptness and inability to fight this, you know, global pandemic, the cause of humanity. And that's how you control countries. So this is the system. This is what we have. But the reason behind this, that actually, it's not coronavirus. I just do so many interviews. I talk so much. Okay. That, you know, cough once in a while. But anyway.
That's a relief.
So the point is what we're seeing right now, we're seeing a global civilizatory collapse. And coronavirus is, it's just an excuse for what's coming. And what's coming, again, on the one hand, the elite need to write off all the debts and responsibilities, which is, you know, $2.5, $3, or $4 quadrillion. So people understand, Kevin, it's 4 and 15 zeros. There's no amount of money printing will save the world from what's coming now. And this is one of the reasons. Another reason, and again, you know, I talk about this in several of my books. One of them is Tavistock Institute, but also, you know, I talk about it in Bilderberg, warning the world back 15 years ago when it first came out in 2005. But we're looking at an electronic concentration camp without tears, because again, with a global collapse comes the need to control the population. And if you remember, you know, in Brave New World, Huxley, you know, he centered on the scientific methodology for keeping all populations outside the elite minority in a permanently autistic-like condition actually in love with their servitude. And this is what we're looking at right now. But not only Huxley, H.G. Wells was talking about the same thing. That, you know, he was saying, this isn't a conspiracy. This is a one-world brain functioning as a policy of the mind. So what we're seeing now, right now again, is on the one hand, it's the collapse of biblical proportions, because it's a systemic collapse. There's no coming out of this. And also on the other hand, you know, we're seeing a change, and this is very important because nobody's talking about this. We're seeing a change from the fifth to the sixth techno paradigm, where this, again, if you kind of look, what does it mean? Well, it means this. If you kind of look at the economies, the fourth techno paradigm was industrial economy. And we had this before. And then the fifth techno paradigm is post-industrial economy, which is financial technology, you know, IT services, entertainment, telecommunications. Well, we're gone. We're past that. Now we're into the sixth, which is, you know, you can call it trans-industrial economy. What is that? Robotics, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, additive technologies, you know, 3D printing, you know, nanobioinfocognitive convergence, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we get to the seventh techno paradigm in about 20 years, or maybe even less, we're talking about man machines, real transhumanism, you know, fusion, helium 3 bases on the moon, all that other kind of stuff. So with the change from the fourth techno paradigm, which is engineers and architects, you know, they were replaced by lawyers and and bankers and, you know, effective managers, accountants, and financiers. Fifth techno paradigm is luxury goods and services and cell phones and, you know, and smartphones and, you know, mass infrastructures, mass tourism. All of this is gone, and gone for good. It is never coming back. Banks will fail. You know, the financial sector will collapse. We're seeing literally, you know, governments taking over economies. You know, we're talking about centralized control. Whether you like it or not, centralized control is called socialism. If you don't like that, I'll give you another term, national socialism. And so this is what we have. We have, on the one hand, the need to dismantle the old sector, which no longer, you know, gives benefit to those who actually ran it. That's the fifth techno paradigm, post-industrial economy, which was put together, you know, in the last 40 years with Reaganomics, et cetera. And on the other, the need to change from one paradigm to another. And this is what we're having right now. So all these things that are happening, you know, this is like, you know, going from global 1.0, which is Westphalia world, So that's 1648 to, you know, the late 1960s, nation states, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have Global 2.0. That's One World Company Limited. The Bilderbergers talk about this in their Bilderberg Conference. When they decided in 1968, no, when they decided to create the concept of a One World Company Limited, corporations more powerful than any government on the planet, you know, Goldman Sachs and company. And then we were into Global 3.0, that's post-industrial. And now we're in Global 4.0, which is a change in governing model, change in production paradigm. And the thing is, we have never changed models of government without global conflict, you know. And right now, if you kind of look at it, what do we have? We have fights between governments. We have government against corporation. You have corporation against corporation. You have dominant culture against, you know, versus other cultures. Then you have legislative branch against executive branch against judiciary. Then you have the elite versus the people, locals versus the migrants, humans versus transhumans, culture one versus culture two. And any of these conflicts, any one of them can lead to war. But when all of them are happening at the same time, not even a global war can solve. And what's the problem? And the problem is that nobody on the entire planet has a conceptual vision of the world post-crisis.
Wow. Well, that's a very, very interesting analysis. Two questions I would have for you about this. First, the question of whether there is actually what could be called a pandemic, in the sense of what do you think the facts are about this novel coronavirus, which has a very, very high transmissibility index. So it's extremely contagious, not super lethal, perhaps kills 0.5%, maybe 1%, but probably a lot less than that of the people it hits. But it's so contagious that it's likely to, you know, really knock out a lot of people really fast, which is this is how they design bioweapons, of course, is to do precisely that. So I just want to make sure you're on the same page as in terms of this being real, and what they tell us it is, more or less. And then the second thing is the issue of geopolitics and how that plays into this, because my analysis of this is very similar to yours. I agree completely about this is to write off the debt. There's a crisis in capitalism, but I would say it's Western bankster capitalism, privately created money that is in crisis. The Chinese model with 80% public-owned banking has done much better. They've been growing double digits overall for 40, 50 years. And so from a geostrategic perspective, as people like the I'm forgetting the name of the guy I'm thinking of who wrote an article on China's unpeaceful rise, John Mearsheimer, he points out that it's absolutely necessary for the U.S. from a geopolitics perspective to slow or stop Chinese economic growth the way we stopped Japanese growth back in the 80s. And that there's likely to be World War III with China based on all precedents. So I would throw that in as the people that produced this virus very likely were working out of military labs and radically disrupting the world economy, not only to write off Western banks, but also to take down these globalized trade systems that have been the fuel or the engine driving China's rise. So I think there's a geopolitical aspect of this. So those are the two questions. What are the facts about the actual virus and how dangerous it is? And then secondly, do you think there is a U.S. versus China or Western banksters versus Chinese state banks angle to this?
Okay. First of all, I'm not a virologist. So, you know, when I hear a lot of talk about all the kind of stuff, I'm not an expert. I'm a doctor of conceptual intelligence. In other words, what we do is we create models that define the future, you know, at least a generation in advance. But let me start with the second question first. I don't agree that there's going to be a war between the United States and China, because China and the United States, they're all part of the same, they're part of the same system. Let me explain, because a lot of people don't understand this. Actually, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, they're on the same page with Putin. Now, let me start, you know, with China and the United States. Okay, China is and the United States is the same coin. It's heads and tails of the same coin. And they're all part of what's known as the Bretton Woods model. Now, how did this Bretton Woods economic model work? Well, it's very easy. In the United States, they printed money, and this money then is legalized through multinational banks. further this money, companies are built in China and other third world countries. Then these companies sell cheap goods to the United States of America, and the same financial corporations offer cheap credits to American citizens to buy these goods. Everything is wonderful, but there's only one problem. America doesn't make the money, but rather transnational corporations. Since these corporations, Kevin, are usually based in the United States and lend money to American citizens, there's a feeling that things are going, you know, hunky-dory. But this mechanism, especially its financial aspect, stopped working after the 2008 crisis. And if we look at the economic growth over the past 12 years, it has been at the expense of, excuse me, faster growth of debt than this. There was no real growth. In fact, if you kind of subtract from the equation all the money printed in America since Reaganomics, which started in 1981, that's 40 years ago, the actual growth in the U.S. over the past 40 years is exactly 0%. So the result was this. In the financial sector, the United States ceased to receive income since international corporations stopped investing. In other words, it stopped being profitable. But at the same time, China continued to receive income from trade. That is, there used to be parity. But in different areas. In America, or the United States, had surplus in the financial sector and China in trade. And now it has turned out that China has a surplus in trade while the United States does not have surplus in the financial sector. And in this situation, Trump began to change the model. He said to Xi Jinping, he said, hey, let's return production. Well, he said it to America. Let's return production to the United States and make America great again. However, he also said, then the main enemy of the American people is international financial corporations. Now, as far as the U.S. China deal, the surplus of foreign trade balance with America, with the United States, is $500 billion. So Trump's goal is the reindustrialization of the United States. And so how could China respond to this? The situation there is also fairly awful economically. Yes, China's annual foreign trade surplus has reached almost $1 trillion. Now, again, it would seem that everything is fine, but the Chinese balance of payments has always been negative. Now, what does that mean? The Chinese annually print in yuan an equivalent of $4 trillion U.S., while China's GDP is $16 trillion. We're talking about 25%. The real U.S. GDP is about $14, $15 trillion. The rest is pure fiction. I mean, you can paint any graph you want on a piece of paper. So what does all this stuff mean if the Chinese print an equivalent in dollars of $4 trillion? Because we're talking about, you know, if they stop doing that, what does it mean? If you take away that opportunity to withdraw this excess from the circulation through dollars, it means that there will be an inflation of 25%. And the Chinese leadership is categorically not happy with this process. And I'm inclined to believe that it has arranged a kind of asymmetrical response. And its logic is very simple. The Chinese are saying, okay, so the whole world economy lives on Chinese spare parts. Okay, we're the sweatshop of the entire world. And now we will arrange, as if it were, quarantine. And let's see what happens to your economy and to your economy and to your economy, you know, whether they're talking about Germany, whether they're talking about Europe, or talking about the United States, or wherever. Okay, so therefore, be so kind as to buy our products or try to quickly restore your own production. And I can assure you that you will need at least 3-4 years minimum to do this. I understand that the Japanese are moving their productions out of China. It's not a Lego piece that you just take, you know, from place A and put in place B. The entire logistics is about 3-4 year process. And given the overheating of stock markets, there is no time. There is no 4 years. Because the real financial collapse starts in September. And I think that the financial liberal globalist deep state have taken up the Chinese position in the sense. The logic here is simple. If American economy collapses now, if we can make it tank, that's what the Clintonoids and company are saying, the people of Trump will drive away and elect another president. He'll be driven away and they'll elect another president in November 2020. I wrote a book 2 years, actually 3 years ago it came out. It's called In the Shadows of a Presidency. Okay. The whole thing behind Donald Trump. And what's important to understand that Trump, Xi Jinping and Putin, they're the same team. And the fact that Trump and there's a lot of, you know, dialectic and rhetoric, you know, public rhetoric between Trump and China doesn't mean that they're enemies. Real diplomacy is done, you know, in behind closed doors. The rest is cover story. And all the stuff you're seeing right now, the United States are threatening Chinese and not paying, you know, their obligations, you know, all the monies that the Chinese have spent in the American economy. This is not what it seems to be. The real reason behind is that China, okay, because their time is different. Our time is linear, you know, progression, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Their time is the sum of different periods of history. And for the Chinese to become one, they need Taiwan to become part of China before the year 2025, which means that the Chinese will do everything in their power, including invading Taiwan, to make sure it becomes part of the motherland.
Why 2025?
Because this is the year, if you're looking at the Chinese cycles of time, this is the time, 2025. Because in China, there's three stages. There's one called chaos, the second is small renaissance, and the third stage is Great Datun, which is the union of the entire, you know, the entire peoples of Chinese diaspora. They already have Macau, they already have Hong Kong, they need Taiwan, which is one. This is the red line. If America decides to defend Taiwan, there will be a war because the Chinese will get Taiwan back. However you want to look at this. And what we're seeing right now is negotiation behind the scenes. Because the Chinese are saying to Trump, okay, how much money do you want for us, you know, for you to let go of Taiwan? And all this public stuff you see right now, this is just, you know, the cover story for the behind the scenes negotiation. And the price that we're seeing from the intelligence point of view, because again, I spent 25 years in Russian military counterintelligence, okay, is about $5 trillion. This is the money that the Chinese are offering the United States. And that's why, you know, the Americans are talking about not paying, you know, their obligations. Because the money is more or less the same, $5 trillion. So again, China and the United States, they are the same team. And Xi Jinping and Trump, they're buddies, just like Trump and Putin. It doesn't mean there's some, you know, wicked, wild conspiracy theory. It's actually very easy. Again, as I said before, between 1944 and 1991, you have this, you know, two economic models. And in some things, you know, the Western world was better. In other things, like, you know, the social welfare, et cetera, the Soviet Union satellites were better. Demographically, they were very similar. And then when the Soviet system collapsed, why it collapsed, it goes beyond the scope of this interview. Okay, but it has very little to do, it has, but little to do with the fact that the Soviet system was inadequate, because in 1991, not many people know this, the Soviet Union was growing 10% per year. Suffice to say that these two systems merged into this one global parasitical liberal banking financier system. And if before the fight was between, you know, West and East, in 1991, it turned within the capitalist world between the financiers. These are the people who play with numbers on the computers and today control 70% of global economy, and the industrialists, isolationists, whose face is Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not a person. He's a project. He is a representative of an alternative group of people. And what you're seeing right now is the fight to the death. And I am inclined to believe that this whole coronavirus thing, and again, I have no idea where it came from because I'm not a virologist. And to give my opinion on this would be absolutely insane because, you know, it would disqualify me as, you know, as an expert in any other field. But what is absolutely obvious from a conceptual point of view is that everybody is taking advantage of this for many different reasons. One, because of the global collapse. Everybody is shoring up their civil defenses because all the stuff we're seeing right now, they're talking about microchipping population, they're talking about electronic passports. By the way, all the stuff I talked about in my Bilderberg book way back in 2005 when people are laughing. I remember you interviewing me, I think like 2007.
Yeah. You're saying all this stuff, pretty much what we're seeing now.
People are laughing. Yeah. We're seeing it right now. And anybody who says like, this is a conspiracy theory, you're locked up in your home with 6 billion other people. I'm not. I'm on the beach in Mexico. Okay, and so you have all these people, just make sure that people understand that, you know, you have this 6 billion people locked up, an entire humanity is locked up in 7 weeks. It didn't take them very long. We lost our freedoms. Everything that we fought for hundreds and hundreds of years has been taken away from us in a matter of weeks. And then they're saying that you want to go, for example, in Canada, in Holland, in Germany, they're saying that you want to go back to school, you want to attend public events, you want to be able to take a loan out, you're going to have an electronic passport that proves that you've been, you know, vaccinated, you know, and that you're up to speed on all these other different things, which means that as of now, you're going to have different tiers of population, those who have been vaccinated. And again, if you look at liberal banking financier parasitical Europe, you have over 80% of the population of all European countries because they've been dumbed down to the point where brain is mush. You know, where they're saying, absolutely, we need this. We need this because this is done, you know, for our good. Canada is the same thing because it's part of the British Empire. So this is what we're looking at. On the one hand, on the other hand, again, as I said, they're shoring up their defenses in every country in the world because they know that this is not a collapse. This is not, this is a preamble. The real collapse is coming in September. This is going to be the first
thing. Why September?
Because this is, again, this is more or less, without getting into the economics part of it too much, because I know we're running out of time. The point is that this is the first real shock. The first real, real shock is going to come in September, when the economy is going to start collapsing. I want to remind you of something. The Soviet Union, my country, it on the 25th of January, December, sorry, 1991, it disappeared. So people went to sleep in one country called the Soviet Union, and they woke up in another country called Russia. Overnight, literally, they lost the country. They woke up in the next day in a different place. They went to the bank. The banks were closed. In other words, 40% of ex-Soviet citizens lost all their savings. And over the next 2 or 3 years, as a result of the collapse, as a result of the depression, as a result of, you know, the people being depressed, you know, killing themselves, you know, via drugs, via alcohol, via suicides, 25 million Soviet citizens died as a result of that. The United States is about 30 years behind us on this. In other words, what we experienced in 1991, you're going to be experiencing right now. And people who run, you know, governments, they understand this. In fact, International Monetary Fund is talking about, in the United States, you can have as many as 50 million people dead as a result of the collapse. And again, these are the kinds of numbers, you know, which makes sense if you kind of look at the real figures behind what we're seeing right now, which is a human crisis. You know, before the crisis, you had 100 million Americans who were unemployed. Now, in the last 7 weeks, I think it was like 33 million more. And IMF is talking about 35% of the American population not having a job. That's 50 plus million people. An article came out a couple of days ago that for the first time in history of the United States, more than half of America is not working. You have 130 million people on prescription drugs. That's before the crisis. You have 50 million Americans before the crisis who survived thanks to food stamps. You have 25 million Americans who are legal alcoholics. That's before the collapse. 1 in 7 do hard drugs on a daily basis. That's before the collapse. And what's coming now with all the things we're seeing, and again, we're seeing how terribly unprepared America is, because you've never, ever in your entire existence seen anything like this. I mean, you've seen it in Hollywood films happening over there, be it Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, you know, Russia, China, North Korea. But never in your entire life have you ever thought of seeing this in, you know, in America, which is why when it started happening, okay, with the first jolt, people went to the store and bought lots of toilet paper and Coke, which is, you know.
I wondered about that. I didn't understand that.
Well, it's very easy. It's like, you know, they're obviously planning, you know, planning on sitting in the bathroom drinking Coke for the next, I don't know how many years. What we're seeing right now, Kevin, is an end of a model, okay? If we think we can get back to the way it were a couple of months ago, back to globalization over the next few months, okay, people have no idea what's coming. We never again, for as long as we live, are getting back to the way it was. What we're seeing right now, we've only seen twice in the last 2,000 years. The first time, when the old order collapsed between the 4th and the 6th century, and feudalism, you know, came about. And the second time between the 16th and the 17th century, when feudalism was replaced by capitalism, which means that unless we have someone who, you know, who's like 350 years old, what we're seeing right now is absolutely new to every person on the planet Earth. And this isn't 2008. This isn't 1987. You know, this isn't 1929. This is about two times worse than 1929. And again, one of the consequences of this global collapse is a change from the 5th to the 6th techno paradigm, which is, again, the rise of robotics, artificial intelligence, virtual world. And in this world, robots take place and take precedence over humans, which means that 90% of people will have nothing to do, which means that, you know, we have to define or redefine a role for the human beings. And for the elite, they need to do something with these 90% of the people have nothing to do. Which is why for them, the global thermonuclear war would have been amazing.
Right. Well, they have kind of a choice between universal basic income and killing everybody off.
Universal basic income doesn't solve your problem. You can give people money short term, but eventually people are going to go insane. You know, they're going to want to go to work. They're going to, because again, working is, you know, is also having a place in society, having a reason to be, and gives meaning to your life. And the fact that you have 90% of the people not doing anything, I mean, look at America right now. You have, you know, an increase, 47% increase in divorce rates. This is the worst time to get divorced. You got to stay together as a family. There's so much stuff happening all over the world right now, which is a direct consequence of, you know, of this coronavirus thing, which is why, again, I said to you when you asked me the question like 10 minutes ago, I'm not a virologist. I have no idea where this thing came from. It doesn't really make a difference. It could have come from the United States. It could have come from China. It could have come from, you know, from England, which is something I wouldn't doubt because the British Empire is not dead. They're doing their utmost to, you know, to survive at everybody else's expense. But, you know, again, yesterday, I think it was, you know, German intelligence and German scientists, they said that, you know, this thing didn't come from China. Whether the Germans are playing along with Chinese, I don't know, but it's irrelevant from a conceptual point of view. We are at a point in history where we have no image of the future. And this is terrible because for the first, again, if you kind of look at history, any change from one techno paradigm to another was accompanied, okay, with a fairly smooth transition. But this thing, because why? Because we had an image of the future and a model, economic model. But for the first time in this, you know, trans-industrial post-capitalist world, we have no model to replace Bretton Woods system. Which means that if you have no model, this vacuum will be replaced by extreme violence. And this is where we're heading. And that's why they're talking about universal income. That's why they're talking about electronic passports. That's why, you know, they're talking about, you know, copying Chinese social rating system. I mean, social rating system, we already have that. Okay. It's right now not at the level of the Chinese, but it's going to be up to speed. And this is what's happening globally. So again, I don't think we need to go into the, you know, where did this thing come from and how dangerous it is. Because again, if you look at the pandemic numbers, pandemic quote unquote, because it's not a pandemic, and you look at the death rate, the fact that somebody tells me that 200,000 people are dead and another million will die means nothing to me. Okay. You got to look at the percentage of the population. Why aren't people doing this? Because the education system is garbage and they, you know, they were untaught how to think. But if you kind of look, as you said earlier, you know, the death rate is like 0.1, which means it's nothing. Okay? And if you compare it with other diseases out there, you know, it's infinitely more deadly, you know, malaria that, you know, infects annually 450 million people. Okay? And I don't know, I can't remember how many million die. So, but the point is that if you look at the numbers, this is nothing. But the fact is this is the greatest, you know, hybrid warfare, military style media campaign in the history of humanity. Because yeah. Future wars, as you said earlier, they're not going to be fought on the battlefields because everybody has nuclear. Because in the very near future, nuclear technology is going to be, you know, the prerogative of poor countries. Not wealthy, but poor, because wealthy countries are going to be using bacteriological and biological weapons to fight. Because it's a silent killer. You can, you know, kill an entire race of people. That's what Nazis wanted to. That was their dream. And this is where we're heading. So again, it doesn't make a difference. I know you have to go, but it doesn't really make a difference with, you know, who is behind this. Everybody benefited it. From Russia to the United States to Europe, everybody got something out of this coronavirus thing.
Yeah. And that,
not to mention Bill Gates and company.
Yeah. That's why, it's, you know, it seemed a little too perfect and it's pretty easy to imagine the kind of forces that would have been behind it. And ultimately, I'm not so sure that you're right about how low the death rate is, but certainly it looks like the economic effects will kill far more people than the virus will. We're talking about a quarter of a billion people in danger of starvation.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. It doesn't matter what the numbers are. Because again, if you kind of look like, you know, if you look at the first, there's a statistics thing came out a couple of months ago, or a couple of weeks ago, sorry. Like for the first 3 months of the year, 10 million babies were aborted. That's 10 million globally. Okay. And if you compare the numbers, you know, to people who are actually, you know, dying of coronavirus, well, you know, there's a big difference. And then you compare it to, you know, just a common flu, where 700,000 people die every single year. That's about 55,000-60,000 per month. So since this thing started in November, that's like 6 months. That's about 350,000 people died as a result of common flu, which happens every single year. And what happened this year, like, for example, in Italy. Okay, and I'm going to end with this. Like, for example, in Italy, we have this abnormal rate. You know, some saying it's a different kind of, you know, a virus stem than it was in China. I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert. What is absolutely true, because I've lived in Europe for 24 years, this year was an abnormally warm year in Europe. So a lot of people who normally would have died in Spain and in Italy, they survived, you know, a few extra months, and we died as a result of, you know, this thing a few months later. Okay. Because again, if you kind of look at weather patterns, it was like right now in Canada, for example, it's snowing. It's snowing in Toronto. It's snowing in Ottawa. Snowing. We're like on the 10th of May. It has never snowed in Canada on the 10th of May.
Yeah. We just had a hard frost here in Wisconsin.
Well, exactly. So you're looking at, you know, you're looking at kind of a counter effect. It was warm before, which should have been cold. Now it's cold when it should be warm. So you have like -1 degrees, you know, Celsius, in Ottawa, and it's snowing. And in 3 days, you have like +22. Then like 4 days later, you have like -4. So needless to say, old people, weather changes, they're brutal on the body. So again, there's lots of things we can look at which have nothing to do with the virology, because again, I don't want to get into this because it's not my field. I'll be just saying what someone else was saying.
Well, let me get to your field here. Just that you can make this answer as short as you want, but just do you think it's likely that at last year's Bilderberg conference, somebody at that conference knew this was coming?
The fact that they knew it was coming, it has nothing to do with Bilderberg. Absolutely, they knew this was coming. If we kind of, you know this infamous Rockefeller Foundation report that came out a few months ago from back in 2010, where they're talking about creating this pandemic, which will happen in 2012. Well, this is like 2010. So obviously these people knew, and they were talking about 7.5 million people dead, you know, 3-year pandemic, need to wear electronic passport, need to look up people. This is like the Rockefeller Foundation, 2010, which is, again, the same thing as the Bill Gates Foundation, the same thing as the Soros, the same thing, you know, as all the American institutes and you know, this think tanks, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same group. But Bilderberg has nothing to do with this anymore. Bilderberg, and this is coming from the guy who wrote, the definitive book on the Bilderbergers, which, you know, was sold in 64 countries and translated into 46 languages. Okay, Bilderberg no longer means anything to anybody, because Bilderberg was a very important element of a liberal banking financier post-World War II structure. Okay? Liberals, in other words, these are the people behind Hillary Clinton. These are the Clintonoids, these are, you know, the intelligence apparatus, the American bureaucracy, not American, global bureaucracy, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, you know, the mainstream media, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, all these presidents from all these countries that Trump, you know, always fights against, and people are saying Trump is nuts. These are allies. France is not an ally of the United States. Italy, Spain, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, NATO alliance. These are not allies of Donald Trump. World Health Organization, they are his enemies because they're part of the global liberal banking operation apparatus. And that's why Trump is fighting, because Trump became president again for two reasons. One, to dismantle Bretton Woods, which he has done very effectively. And two, to dismantle petrodollar system, which is a system, a cornerstone of his enemies of the liberal banking system, which was established post-World War II. So Bilderberg being part of the same global liberal banking financier system, because the system itself that they represent is on its deathbed and has nowhere to go because reached the limits of growth. And the little machine that prints money, called the emission center in the United States, is controlled by their enemy, which is Trump. Bilderberg no longer has the voice to actually change the dynamic globally. And the entire, again, repeat, liberal banking system is on its deathbed. And that, which is why I tend to believe that it is they, realizing the consequences of what's coming, overturned the game table and said, you know, chaos, let's see what happens. We're going to create this pandemic with the help of our buddies at World Health Organization and all the institutes and world media. And this is our only chance to somehow retake the initiative via chaos, you know, and this disorganized global conflict, and try to get rid of Trump and try to come out winners on the other side.
So, and the Chinese order are playing out of chaos.
Along. Exactly. And the Chinese are playing along because, again, for Xi Jinping, although he is, you know, Trump's buddy, the system that Trump proposes is not good for them. It's not very effective, which is why he wants to get rid of Trump. Not because he doesn't like him. He does. Okay, but despite of that, you know, the fact that, you know, Trump is pushing them to change a model which has been very effective, because China rose thanks to the liberal banking financier model, thanks to being included in the American market, which is, again, when people say there's going to be war, I can't possibly see that, because again, it's the same coin, it's head and tails of the same coin. They're part of the same model, and that's what Trump is trying to renegotiate, not change, renegotiate. And what we're seeing right now, for example, in China, Xi Jinping fighting the same liberal apparatus. Because again, if you kind of go back to the initial stages of coronavirus in Wuhan. Who runs Wuhan? Who runs, you know, the governorship? The liberal banking financiers. And they are, they've organized, you know, this closure of the entire province, of the entire city, with locking down 50 million people. It wasn't organized with a central government. It was just decided. So just imagine the governor of California decides to shut down, you know, the state without first, you know, talking to the president of the United States about this. This was done in China. It was an open provocation against Xi Jinping. And the same thing we're seeing in Russia, which, you know, the liberal banking financier apparatus run by the central banking company, which are enemies, sworn enemies of Putin. They're doing the same thing. So it's a global conflict. You have Trump, Xi Jinping, and Putin on one side, and you have all the liberal banking financier apparatus on the other. Who wins? We will win, because, again, that model's on its deathbed. And the only way they have out of this is trying to print the money. But no matter how much money you print now, you can't get out of the system. So we'll win. We will come up with a new model. We're in for a very, very bumpy ride, and I think we'll prevail.
Okay, well, I guess that's a good place to leave it, although I wanted to ask about the oil angle, the end of the petrodollar. You said Trump was designed, you know, he was put in to end the petrodollar. Now we have the complete collapse of global oil prices and the collapse of the U.S. shale industry. So if you have something to say, brief to say about that, I'd be curious to hear it.
I can go into great detail on the oil thing, because, again, the fall of American WTI oil to negative values, it does need an explanation. First of all, this price is not for oil but for futures, which means only one thing, that, you know, today's production is such that there is nowhere to store the oil. And so due to coronavirus, demand fell sharply, but the production did not. And at the same time, it's also difficult, you know, and scary to cut production. Why is it scary? Well, because loans have long been taken out against the production projections, loans which must be obviously repaid, especially among shale producers who must continuously drill new wells to maintain the total volume, since their capitalization and also credit worthiness in particular depends on it. And in order to drill, they need loans. So as a result, the current negative oil prices are simply the cost of the lack of capacities to store oil. But for vertically integrated companies, for example, there is no such problem at all. They deliver it to their own plants that produce gasoline, produce oil, and also produce plastic. And yes, they can suffer a little from today's storm on the stock exchange, but still, the technological complex is not going anywhere. Who will be left standing holding the bag? Those who played up the hype and suffered as a result. So in reality, the price of Brent oil in Western Europe today is higher than it was, for example, a couple of weeks ago, at a minimum of about $25 a barrel. That is, there is no hysteria there at all. And therefore, the result of today's prices will be a completely natural process. Production will fall significantly in a couple of months. In particular, the entire shale adventure will be shut down. And I want to focus on two points of principle, and that I will, you know, will end the interview. The first one is that the mechanism of oil pricing created by transnational banks is so divorced from the real industry and real demand for oil products that due to purely internal, that is financial mechanisms, it entered into a collapse. And the main victims will not even be small oil and processing companies, but banks, since their magic making money out of nothing is a thing of the past, as is their overreaching influence, given that they cannot maintain stability in such a vital market as the oil market. As, you know, some power broker, I can't remember his name, said, the dollar in the world is needed so that Saudi Arabia can sell their oil to China. Or for simplicity, petrodollar rules the world. So this world, like petrodollar, is over. It is dead. And if it is over, if the capitalization of oil companies returns to normal figures related to profit, production reserves, that not oil companies, but banks will lose. Remember, Kevin, it is the transnational banks which were the main beneficiaries of the process of increasing capitalization. And the second point I want to make is no less important than the first. The current situation shows that there can no longer be a single pricing in Western Europe and the United States for oil. That is, prices will begin to be determined in regional markets. In particular, this refers to the market controlled by China. And it's understandable why. I think that China is ready to accept excess oil for quite acceptable, you know, surcharge from the United States. It remains to be seen whether the United States agrees. But we're seeing again that the petrodollar model has come to an end, because it was the model designed post-World War II Bretton Woods liberal banking financier world. And if there's no petrodollar, there's no need for a single dollar system. Oil will start to cause differently regional markets. In other words, the mechanism that arose in 1944 in the Western world at the Bretton Woods Conference and which spread to the entire world in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, no longer works. So what we're seeing, you know, with the with the price of oil as a commodity going to zero, which, you know, anyone with a sense of understanding how things work knows that commodities such as oil can't be priced at zero. What it is, it's actually attacked not against oil, but against one global market where everything is priced in dollars. And Trump is saying that you want your oil, you know, priced above zero, you know, regionalize it, price it in your own markets, whatever you want. We're going GATA, we're going Make America Great Again, we're shutting the doors on, you know, on our country, and we're going to price our oil in dollars, and you can price your oil in yuan, in euros, or in whatever you want, but not in dollars, which is, again, as I said before, Trump became president of the United States with two very, very, you know, defined objectives. One, dismantling of the Bretton Woods system, which is a post-World War system, which defined the post-World War world. And the second, dismantling of the petrodollar system, which is a system run by his enemies.
Okay. Well, I think we've hit the end of the hour. And I appreciate your staying on for a little longer because it's fascinating stuff.
We're going to do half an hour, but there's just so much to discuss.
There always is. Well, thank you so much, Daniel Estulin. It's always great checking in with you, and your analysis always seems to be a little ahead of its time. So I'm going to be ready to short sell September.
Do that. But I think important point here, again, just, you know, to finish on a positive note, there will be no hot war between China and the United States. Because again, Trump and Xi Jinping, they're part of the same team. What you're seeing is just an open negotiation for things going on behind the scenes. And second, they cannot be a hot war because China and the United States, they are part of the same model. It's, you can't separate them. It's like separating Siamese twins. It makes no sense. It's the same thing. And this agreement was actually reached back in 1979 between Deng Xiaoping and Jimmy Carter. It was a 40-year agreement, 20, and then extended for another 20 until January 2019. And in 2019, Trump and Xi Jinping started renegotiating the deal. And what you're seeing is just the public part of a much bigger behind-the-scenes negotiations. Because, again, we're talking about not only, you know, U.S.-China, we're also talking about the entire rewriting of new economic models for foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, I guess that's a little more positive. Well, thank you. Daniel,
there will be no war between China and the United States.
No war.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, that's good to hear. All right. Take care.
Take care.